I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. You know how much I love talking about food, and this is going to be another great hour talking about my favorite subject, food. I can't wait to get started with my guests. But first, I just want to take a moment like I typically do. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for tuning in, love, because that's what this show is really about. It's about love and all the good things that we can do on this planet, our home, Earth. I love autumn, and we're really into autumn right now in New York City. I'm looking out my window. The leaves are turning colors. The air is so fresh. I'm enjoying the coolness, wearing a sweater finally. It's beautiful, and I'm grateful for all of that. I'm really looking forward to speaking to my guest, Michael Abelman. He's the co-founder and director of Soul Food Street Farms. He's one of the early visionaries of the urban agriculture movement. He has created high-profile urban farms in Watts, California, Goleta, California, and Vancouver, British Columbia. He has worked on and advised dozens of similar projects throughout North America and the Caribbean, and he's the founder of the nonprofit Center for Urban Agriculture. He's the subject of the award-winning PBS film Beyond Organic, narrated by Meryl Streep. His previous books include From the Good Earth, On Good Land, and Fields of Plenty. He lives and farms at the 120-acre Foxglove Farm on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. We're going to be talking about his new book, Street Farm. Hi, Michael. How are you today?
So nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, and I am so honored to speak with you. I read a lot of books, especially for this program. And I've come to realize my favorite books are the ones like yours about farming and growing food and doing it the way, I don't even know how to put this, because your way of farming is kind of just so out of the box or in the box. But growing food organically with passion, with care, with focus, with love, and creating something nutritious and delicious and building so much more than just a meal on our plate. I love stories like that, and I loved your book, and I love your story, and I want to talk as much as we can in the next half hour about it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know how you were raised, but I love the idea that you felt this need to create something that was not only something you believed in, but you were creating a business that were employing people that are normally unemployable.
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so where did you find that in yourself to do something like that?
Well, Karen, I'm 62 years old. I've been farming since I was 18, commercially, primarily in, you know, more traditional farms, the farms that people would see in their mind's eye if they thought farm. But I have in recent years really felt the pull to use my skills in a way that reached out to folks who either did not have access to good quality fresh food or to jobs, to meaningful work. Individuals who were on the fringes, on the edges. You know, we started this project, Soul Food Street Farms, about 8 years ago in a neighborhood called the Downtown East Side, which is the neighborhood where the term Skid Row was coined. We employ 25 people, all of whom are managing some form of long-term addiction or mental illness. You know, I have to say that when you know, when I first visited that neighborhood, I came to that neighborhood with the same preconceptions and judgments and prejudices that I think we all do. If you see somebody on the sidewalk with a needle in their arm, or somebody else pirouetting in the middle of the street high on crack, you make judgments. We all do.
Yep.
But I have since discovered that those same individuals have an incredible amount of creativity and intelligence and the desire to do something meaningful in the world. And all that we did was provide the, kind of set the table and provided a place for them to to have a meaningful engagement, really simple. And we've done that through large-scale urban agriculture production on parking lots through a very innovative box system. We produce 25 tons. That's 25 tons. That's 50,000 pounds of food annually. Remarkable on 4+ acres of primarily, as I say, parking lots, paved land. Mm-hmm. And we do it with the hands of individuals who never, you know, previously were considered to be unemployable, as you mentioned. Now, many of whom are highly skilled and wonderful farm workers. So, yeah.
I'm just getting all teared up thinking about it because this is a beautiful thing. Right now, our mainstream media, especially here in the United States, is crammed with all this political trash and garbage and people just getting all emotional and angry about nonsense. And here is a way. Now, you said it's simple. I don't know that it's necessarily simple because your book definitely goes into the challenges that you've experienced. Yeah. But we can all make a profound difference, and by getting our hands dirty, for one, people that I associate with a lot on a regular basis want convenience. And, you know, if we could just push our limit a little bit, I just found your book so inspirational, I would hope that it would inspire people to get their own ideas. I live in New York City. I remember visiting Vancouver a number of times. It's a beautiful city. I only saw the modern, touristy kind of beautiful spaces. I wasn't looking in some of the places that you described. And I don't think I've been there in the last few years when your farms have been developed, so I haven't had an opportunity to see them. But there's such a vast gap between the privileged and the not privileged. And our current system wants everybody to fit into a certain mold, and clearly we don't, even in our school systems. And there are many people that have abilities, if they could only be nurtured by someone like yourself and your peers, and give them a chance. Such a beautiful story.
Yeah, I mean, the story that I tell in the book Street Farm is, it's the story of what we've done in what is the poorest neighborhood in anywhere in the country. But it's also an emblematic story. It's a story of what is happening and could happen anywhere. You know, we have currently we have epidemic levels of opiate addiction. And now, in recent times, very high levels of overdose. The issues that we face in the downtown east side of Vancouver are similar to those that exist elsewhere. The downtown east side is an extreme example, certainly. But the when I describe our approach as being simple, I'm suggesting that the idea, the concept, the means by which we reach out to people is simple. The technical parts of it more complicated, certainly, you know. But, you know, people, when they have something meaningful to do, a reason to get up out of bed each day, when they have a choice that they can make between something that's going to continue to bring them down and something that might lift them up, a community of people that depend on them, plants that rely on them daily for attention in order to survive, neighborhoods that need food that's being produced and from those plants. All of these things help to inform someone's ability to kind of lift themselves up and participate in a meaningful way, and to even if it's for a half a day, to step out of their addictions, out of their challenges, and feel a little more sense of pride and accomplishment. You know, and I think that's the simplicity of this. We're not social workers. We're not addiction experts. We're not psychologists. We're farmers that have provided the space for people to come together. And it's been the results of that have been rather profound. As I write about in the book, I profile a lot of the individuals who we work with, and it's pretty amazing, really.
Many of us have acknowledged that there's a big disconnect today in our current society, a disconnect between where our food comes from, especially in urban environments, and a disconnect between the other living species animal and plant species on this planet. There's a big disconnect, and it's a very healing thing when we reconnect with everybody else we're living with and sharing on this planet, be it plants and non-human animals. And so it's just really exciting to see. We see urban farms. There's plenty that are starting to happen in New York City, and it's a great thing. I was just walking through. I was meeting my parents yesterday for lunch, a little family lunch in a neighborhood on Long Island where I grew up. I took the train, and I walked to the big mall where we were meeting, and I walked through a somewhat depressed town. It was never an affluent town as I remember it, and it looked really beat up. But I was halfway through your book already, and I passed numerous paved, fenced-in lots where some weeds were growing. And all of a sudden, I was filled with hope that I didn't have before because I saw them as farms. I thought, oh, someone could plant a whole bunch of stuff right here. And, oh, there's another place right here. Because you talked about how great these paved areas were for farming.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the early 1980s, I had been visiting a number of urban communities, most primarily low-income communities in the States where I am originally from. And there's a few things that I noticed. One was that very little access to fresh food. Most of there had been a major supermarket flight from those neighborhoods, and the only food items you could find might have been at a liquor store or 7-Eleven. There were also access to work was and jobs was an area that was really lacking, especially meaningful jobs. At the same time, I witnessed all these abandoned lots like what you described. I thought, my gosh, if we could use those lots, we could provide and create working enterprises to provide employment for folks and to provide food for folks, and not in a garden scale. What I had always focused on was a production scale, something that really could produce a lot of food and a lot of jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, I did projects, as I think you mentioned, in places like Watts and Los Angeles. I was there when Rudolph Giuliani was threatening to auction off all those community gardens way back when, and I gathered together some well-known people, David Brower and Alice Waters and other folks, and we kind of rallied some energy around that, have felt for some time that this idea of urban agriculture was more than just gardening, and it was more than just about food. In those days as well, if you use the words urban and agriculture in the same sentence, you were looked at a little bit strangely. You know, so when we started that Center for Urban Agriculture, it was certainly well before there was a movement around this.
Mm.
But I have since witnessed some really wonderful creative work being done. My friends at Green Gorillas in New York City and other projects there, and certainly all over the country, are coming up with just some amazingly innovative and creative ways of bringing this energy into the urban areas, and it's pretty exciting.
I wanted to quote a few things that I loved in the book. First, to sum up what you just said, and I'm going to quote you from your book, "We can march on Wall Street, or we can continue to work quietly and diligently in rebuilding the real economy, the one based on soil and sunlight and people working together to grow food." So beautiful. Thank you for writing that.
Yeah, that was something I had written post 9/11 for a speech that I gave to the Bioneers Conference in California. And basically I was talking about, you know, questioning what is patriotism, really, you know. and I think it depends on your view and your definition. And, in that same speech, I proposed that to memorialize those who lost their lives in the World Trade Center, that we consider a living memorial, an urban farm replete with greenhouses and orchards and production crops on the site of the former World Trade Center to celebrate local economy as much as had been previously on that same site as much as the global economy had been celebrated. And it was interesting that the couple organizations, including Green Gorillas, I think got behind that idea. And it was submitted as a one of the memorials. I had no illusions that it was going to be taken seriously. but I think that we need, you know, we need to really be willing to step out and propose things that are somewhat outrageous, because what's going on the other side is somewhat outrageous. You know, I've been watching the presidential campaign and some of the regional campaigns in the U.S. For political office, and I cannot think of one time that I've heard a single candidate say anything about food or farming. Very little about environmental issues. It's hardly ever mentioned, and I know that there are regional candidates that are speaking out on these issues, but I can tell you it's been hard to find anything on that subject. And yet, what is more central, what is more basic to our survival, our well-being, our sense of community, our sense of culture, than food? It's the gathering place. It's what, you know, it is so central. It's something we all have to do every day, you know. Yet it's incredibly precarious. It's remarkably precarious. The industrial system that is bringing it to us is not a healthy system. And it's one of those things that I would hope would be addressed, but it's not, you know.
It's not. I know. I was recently at the EDEX conference at the UN a few weeks ago when there were all the goings on at the United Nations, and I was very excited to attend. And there were a number of speakers from all over the world, and from the Netherlands and the Nordic countries, especially because the EAT Foundation is from Denmark, I believe. And I was waiting. People were talking about how we needed something radical and a revolution, and they mentioned urban agriculture and how we're going to need to grow more food to feed 9 billion people by 2050. And yet nobody ever said what we could do. They talked about addressing the waste issue. They talked about what we need to address access. But, you know, I felt it was a lot of big vocabulary words, and I didn't hear about really any real action. It was very, very frustrating.
Well, I mean, you know, that's one of the things that, and one of the reasons that I wrote the book Street Farm, and because I think that what we've attempted to do with this project in Vancouver is an interesting model and a potential inspiration for communities all over the place. Lots of obstacles, many difficulties. The book is not a fluff piece about all our successes. In fact, it's incredibly honest about all the things that we've failed at, which I think is in many ways more informative. But it does present a blueprint for the possibility of successful, viable urban agriculture enterprises that also have the potential to serve those who are underserved, to reach out to folks both from an employment perspective and from a food perspective. And I think that the book is, if nothing else will, if you read the stories of the individuals in this book, you cannot help but be inspired by their courage, their perseverance, and by the what we have actually achieved with their hands. It's really, it's amazing, you know. The wonderful quote at the beginning, I'll just read to you, because it's really kind of emblematic of the whole book, and it's from the film The Imitation Game, and it's, "Sometimes it is the people no one imagines anything of who do the things that no one can imagine." And I think that really says it all to a great degree,
yep.
You know.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, we all have such great potential, and so many people are just shoved aside.
Yeah.
One of the things I would love to see our agricultural universities, for example, instead of focusing on genetically modified foods and all kinds of newfangled ways to make food, to concentrate on organic farming, to concentrate on how we might grow food in a vertical environment. You mentioned towards the end of the book growing strawberries, an exposition vertically, and you were challenged by it. Well, you know, people can figure out how to do that and do it well. You just need a little time and energy, some investment, of course, which is the big empty space in the equation, because there needs to be money behind it, and our priorities need to be seriously adjusted. There's a number of metaphors that I loved in your book for life. And one of them I'm going to quote where you wrote about fruit, saying the ones that taste the best are almost always those that have suffered.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of context around that statement within the it's written within a broader piece, but actually it's true. I mean, you know, people always laugh when I'm teaching them how to pick strawberries, and you see these little misshapen, terribly ugly little strawberries, and I tell them, I say, look, this will absolutely be the best one you've ever had, and that no one ever believes me until they taste it. It's true. I think that I was kind of playing with that statement to some degree. I'm sure it's not always true, but I have found in many cases it is physically true, but it's more metaphorical in terms of its, you know, use of language. You know, so.
There's actually science behind it.
Yeah, probably is. I wouldn't know that.
Yeah, there's, well, when there's been some studies with hydroponics where the another study, I'm getting all wound up here, but when plants have to work harder, they get stronger and more flavorful and more nutritious. And when we put pesticides and herbicides in the ground, the plants don't have to work as hard to fight to survive. And as a result, they're not as nutritious and they're not as flavorful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's fascinating. And you were talking about tomatoes, too. When they're exposed to very little water, they have to really struggle, and then you get this intense flavor.
Yeah, dry farming tomatoes, of course, is a long tradition of that. I've done it for many years. I did it when I farmed in California, and we still do some of that here. The grape growers understand this concept very well. They know about, grapevines that are stressed, that are held back, and the quality of fruit that results. You know, so this is very deep, long-held knowledge that we are all just rediscovering.
Yeah, rediscovering. There's so much knowledge that we've lost with big agriculture that we need to absolutely rediscover. Now, there some of the challenges. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of urban land is contaminated. You talked about even if you wanted to, if you were given a piece of land in an urban environment, you wouldn't even want to grow there because it's contaminated. And so you came up with this solution of growing in boxes, and you had to figure out which were the best ones to grow in that would last longer and work the way you wanted to. But is there any hope for reclaiming the land that's under all that pavement?
Well, my friend of mine has always said to me that by paving over our precious topsoil, we are preserving it for future generations, somewhat jokingly. Look, most urban areas everywhere in the world, the native soil that exists, either under pavement, under buildings, is extremely contaminated. It's contaminated from, industry. It's contaminated from runoff. So there are, for especially our older cities, there is just a long, long history of deposition, contamination, lead and asbestos and industrial waste, you name it, all the way down the line. And so it is completely unsafe and somewhat irresponsible to think that we can grow food directly in native soils in urban areas. I don't think it's safe, and we would be hard-pressed to find very many places in most cities anywhere in the world that are safe. So we created a pretty innovative system for isolating the growing medium from either pavement or contaminated soils. It's a box system that we designed and have fabricated. We went through a lot of iterations, a lot of mistakes, which I go into in the book, and now have a wonderful approach to doing this. Boxes that are stackable and nestable. They are have interconnected drains. They can be moved with a forklift, so they address the issue of short-term leases and high-value urban land. They keep the growing medium and the food plants from having any direct contact with native soils, and also allows to grow on pavement. So that's been a long process to come up with that solution, but one that I think would be helpful to people anywhere.
Okay, now I'm going to be a little selfish. I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but as I mentioned before, I live in New York City. I live in an apartment. Occasionally, I've grown things on my terrace. And recently, we received lemons from a cousin in California, and the seeds were like sprouting. The lemons must have been on the old side, but I couldn't deny these seeds an opportunity to grow. So I have these lemon seeds in little pots. And do you have any recommendations? Do you think I can grow a tree in my apartment?
Well, you can certainly grow a tree in your apartment. The lemon tree that will come from the seeds of that fruit will not likely have any resemblance to the fruit itself. They will not grow true to their parent. In order to replicate that lemon, you have to do it vegetatively from cuttings, you know, and grafting and budding. Mm. Citrus is budded, you know. So, yeah, you could do it. And, in fact, there, you know, the Meyer lemon is a lemon that grows very well in remarkably cool and cold environments. That's actually one we grow in Vancouver, British Columbia. We grow Meyer lemons. And so it is doable. You know, you really have to think about protecting those plants, especially in New York in the winter. You know, they're not going to survive a New York winter outside or on your deck.
So. Yeah, no, I know. It would have to be indoors.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay, well, stay tuned. the last thing I wanted to mention, you touched on it briefly. You talked about giving away food and not giving away food, and this idea of like a Garden of Eden. I visit Costa Rica from time to time, and I go to these very undeveloped areas, and when some fruits are in season, they're just dropping everywhere, and it's the most lovely experience, where there's just food to eat everywhere for no cost. You just take it when you want it, and it's such a beautiful image, and you touched on it lightly, but having this opportunity for all of us to eat just like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that concept was brought up within the context of a broader conversation in the book, where I'm talking about encountering a homeless man who had climbed the fence into we have a large urban orchard that's 500 trees producing, you know, persimmons and pears and apples and quince and Meyer lemons and all kinds of things like that. And he was helping himself and loading up bags of stuff, essentially stealing. He told me that, you know, this was God's plants and God's food. And I said, well, God had a lot of help from us in in planting and growing this stuff. And that essentially when he's stealing, he's actually stealing from the very people who are his neighbors and folks who are struggling just as he is. Because if he steals our food, we can't sell it and pay their payroll, you know. You know, after that conversation, I reflected on the idea that in an ideal world, that orchard would have no fence around it. And it would be open and accessible to anyone who needed to come in and enjoy not just the fruits off the trees, but the space itself, you know. but that we live within, we have to live within the realities of having to support the people we are trying to employ, you know. So it's a, it is an internal dilemma that I struggle with on a constant basis, you know. We would prefer to just grow everything, give it away.
I wish more people struggled that, with you know? That. I wish more people
that?
Struggled like you did with that concept. It would be a far better place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael Abelman, thank you for joining me, and it's all about food. Thank you for writing the book Street Farm. I think it can inform and inspire so many people who might have a romantic notion about farming or just want to know more about growing food. Thank you again for joining
Thanks
me.
Thanks so much for having me. Okay. All
okay. Take care. That was Michael Abelman, everybody, the author of Street Farm. You can find out more at soulfoodfarms.com, and that's soul, S-O-L-E, soulfoodfarms.com. Okay, let us move on, shall we? We have some more wonderful guests, but before I get to them, I just wanted to mention, I talked a while back about the Two Forks events with Dr. Esselstyn and his family, and I wondered, I know a number of you have gone to the one in Dallas, and I wondered, what did you think? Because there are some more coming up in Cleveland and in Arizona, and I think we'd like to know more about it. So if you've gone to any of those events, and I know some of you have, let me know at info@realmeals.org. And for those of you who are still considering the other events, you can get a $50 discount. Real 50 is the discount, Real 50. Go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, my nonprofit site, and find out more about the Two Forks event. All right, let's take a very quick break, and we'll be right back and find out about the 2016 Sexiest Vegans Over 50. I can't wait. Okay, everybody, we're back. Welcome to part two of my program. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to bring on a couple of very sexy guests. I have Victoria Moran, who's a vegan of three decades, listed by Veg News Magazine among the top 10 living vegetarian authors and featured twice on Oprah. Victoria has written 12 books, including Main Street Vegan and The Good Karma Diet. She is the host of the weekly Main Street Vegan podcast and director of Main Street Vegan Academy, a six-day in-person program in NYC to train vegan and certify vegan lifestyle coaches and educators. Alongside male winner Dr. Joel Kahn, Victoria was recently voted PETA's Sexiest Vegan Over 50. We also have Dr. Joel Kahn, who is a clinical professor of medicine at Wayne State University School of Medicine and director of Cardiac Wellness, Michigan Healthcare Professionals, PC. He's a graduate summa cum laude of the University of Michigan School of Medicine and lectures widely on the cardiac benefits of vegan nutrition, mind-body practices, and heart attack prevention. He writes blogs for Mind Body Green, One Green Planet, Aloha.com, and ForksOverKnives.com. He also writes for Reader's Digest magazine as the Holistic Heart Doc and his first book, The Whole Heart Solution. Welcome, you sexy people. How are you today?
Woohoo! Dr. Kahn here. I'm feeling very sexy and very vegan.
Tell me about yourself, Dr. Kahn.
You did a wonderful job. The only thing I'd add, because it's pretty unusual, I mean, I'm a practicing cardiologist for over 25 years, vegan for 40. First day undergraduate, University of Michigan. I hated everything but the salad bar. Then I started learning the rest of the story. Thank you, John Robbins and Dean Ornish. And I've stuck with it ever since, teaching heart patients in Detroit that there's a way. I own the trademark Prevent Not Stent, and my hospital hates me for that, but I use it all the time.
I want to talk more about Prevent Not Stent in a moment. Victoria, how are you today?
Nice to hear you, Karen.
Yes, nice to hear you. I gave a little brief introduction about you and your wonderfulness.
Thank you.
And I wanted to understand what sexy means to you too, in terms of the Sexiest Vegan Over 50, which you have just both been awarded the title.
Well, let's let Queen Victoria take that one first.
Well, I would say that it is different after 50, and especially when you're quite a bit after 50, which I am. I'm 66, and I think it becomes more like a lifetime achievement award. When I think of the sexiest woman over 50, now she was vegetarian, not vegan, but, you know, for her day, she was really far ahead. She was somewhere in her 80s, had beautiful white hair. Her name was Iris, and I knew her when I was 19, 20, and when I would be all upset about something going wrong, she would always say, "Oh, it's only life on earth, darling." And that's really what I see. You know, we're going to accept what we can't change, but boy, get out there and change the things we can, like the way people eat.
I love it. And Dr. Khan, how do you feel about what sexy means to you?
Well, I think sexy is being sensitive. Sexy is being open. Sexy is being a male that can talk about loving animals and not wanting them harmed, slaughtered, or used in experiments. Sexy can be to denying wearing leather items and not feeling you need to eat meat to have some sort of testosterone surge, and saying that's all good. And in fact, the last part is, as a medical doctor who specializes in healthy arteries, sexy is better sex because, you know, we have better arteries and they're cleaner on average. Our cholesterol is lower on average. Our blood pressure, our blood sugar. We have less erectile dysfunction. We have a better body odor and some say body taste. So let's just take all the physiology we get as a benefit and celebrate the sexiness.
That's right. Sexy is better sex and a whole lot more. We need more commercials like that, Dr. Khan, instead of those creepy ones that we see with the couples going to the bathtub in the field, their twin bathtubs, and taking Cialis and Viagra and all those crazy things.
I agree. I talk about have a heart attack, not a heart attack, but in case any children are listening, I don't want to go further with that.
It's going to be fun being the co-sexiest vegan for the next year with this man.
Yeah, so what do the two of you plan on doing together?
The first thing we know is that we're going to LA in November to be photographed at the PETA office, and PETA may have some publicity and things lined up for us, and then we're actually going to be working with our own publicists to really try to get this out into the world, because there are so many people who are afraid of growing older, afraid of getting sick. People who are already in this age group. I've talked to 30-year-olds who are like, "Oh my gosh, I don't want to get old." And to really get out there and say, "Hey, there's a way that you can save your own life and some animal lives and maybe even the planet, live better, look better, it's all good."
It's all good. Well, I have to say that I just had dinner with you, Victoria, and you are looking very hot.
Bless you.
I want to thank her. I want to thank Victoria because I've been a cowboy boot-wearing cardiologist since I trained in Dallas, Texas many decades ago, and she introduced me to the amazing line of vegan cowboy boots that are out there. So the two of us are like boots, scoot, and boogies, and it's just funny that now we're together and get to do one-line dancing together for the next 12 months. It's all preordained, all destiny.
And we need to plug the boots. Those are Kat Mendenhall boots. She's an amazing woman.
Yeah.
She's a graduate of a program that I run called Main Street Vegan Academy that trains vegan lifestyle coaches and educators. But many people don't want to coach. They don't really want to work one-on-one or speak to audiences. They want to start businesses. And she's one of those. And she was just madly sketching on the fourth or fifth day of our program. And we all thought she was just taking extreme notes. But she'd come up with the idea for this company of custom Texas cowboy boots made in Texas. All the materials are sourced in America, 100% cruelty free. So, you know, if you want to do some of that two-stepping with us, look up Kat Mendenhall's boots.
You know, I was very happy to learn about her, but she didn't start her business soon enough, because when I was talking to 250 cattle ranchers about animal agriculture's impact on global warming, I wanted to look like them, and I found some vegan cowboy boots and a vegan cowboy hat, but it was hard, and I would have preferred finding them from her, but she wasn't ready to go when I was looking for my outfit.
Everybody needs more than one pair.
Absolutely. You know, it's important to fit in many ways for people to hear your message. So it's appropriate in places where people are wearing cowboy boots to be able to wear cowboy boots. And in other cultures and society, you want to wear what's appropriate in that place because people will hear your message more when they feel like you're one of them.
It's so true, and it's the same thing with the mock meats and the faux cheeses and things like that. People want some of what they're used to, and so often people will say, oh, that's processed. You know, I get it. I know that the vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, that's the best food we can be eating. But, you know, to make this transition and be able to have something that looks and tastes like a burger that you can pick up and eat with your friends, it's important.
I agree. You know, today there's been a little celebration on the internet about Tyson investing in Beyond Meats, you know, a company that's appropriately gotten so much heat for horrible animal practices. And, you know, there's debate going on the web. Is this good or bad? Is this selling out? But they actually fired 10 employees for animal abuse at the same time they announced the deal, said they're clamping down. I mean, I'm not for anything they do, but all of a sudden, they're expressing a conscience, and when a company like that gets behind Beyond Meat, Beyond Meat's going to be in many more grocery stores, better shelf space, and it's what happened with Silk and their soy milk when Dean Foods bought them. All of a sudden, you know, they were much more visible, and they were everywhere because they had such a big company behind them. So, I mean, again, it's a kind of a tough message if you're happy about that or not, but it's bringing it to the public, and sexy Victoria and I just have to, you know, add the persona. It's fun, you know, I'm on no medicines at 57, I have fortunately no aches or pains, and, you know, I seem to be a little bit more energetic than my colleagues after 30 years of doing hardcore cardiology, and I don't credit anything other than the diet for all that.
Well, in addition to being sexy, I think we have to continue to be vigilant, because what happened at Tyson is a good thing. Unfortunately, I think if businesses have the opportunity to exploit, they will, anything to make a better margin and to make a better profit. But if the buying market is saying we don't want to buy cruelty, we want to know that our products are healthy and good for us, and the companies listen, then they will do that. We can't ever get lazy. We need more transparency, and we need to stay on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the people buying, the Walmarts and the big stores, the Costcos, are demanding, you know, chemicals out, better products. And it was reported in the news, some of this was the understanding that they're going to specify cruelty-based food production is not going to be something they're going to source. So, it's the beginning of, you know, a larger change in America that might reach even small-town America, which would be wonderful.
I'm sure you have tons of stories, Dr. Khan, about people who have literally turned their lives around, changed their lives with diet. I was just talking to my sister this morning. My brother-in-law has been doing the low-carb, high animal protein diet for a while. She got his blood test results, and he wanted to know what they were. And she said, bacon and eggs. That was the result. Because the blood results weren't very good.
It mystifies me because we are fighting in the medical blogger and certainly paleo world. The Fat Summit just announced the Fat Summit 2. And, I mean, other than John Robbins and Chris Carr, I wish we could somehow get rid of the 28 other speakers, which includes some very prominent physicians, because they have gone so far to distort medical science and encourage the public to add butter and full-fat cheese.
Yep.
And what we learned decades ago directly causes the disease I fight is coming back in style, and it drives me nuts. And I see you're right. I've seen for decades now diabetes go away, weight go away, people stop having heart, chest pain, people avoid bypass, people not need the second stent because they really got their lifestyle wrapped around, sexual function returning, asthma improving, psoriasis disappearing, and it responds as much as you give to it and all, but it's a serious medical therapy. We have a group in Detroit that we created, plant-based nutrition support group, that we thought would have 20 people dedicated to just supporting each other on this journey. We now have 2,500 members. Mm. It's exploded. Get together once a month. We need Victoria to come in 2017, and because Rich Roll's coming and Chef AJ, we've had them all. It's wonderful. It's a spot for Victoria. And I just want to add to my bio, I own the largest plant-based organic restaurant between L.A. and New York, which added a little panache to my biography and a whole lot of strain to my finances. But my family decided we were going to put our money where other people's mouths were and provide an elegant, upscale, full liquor, vegan restaurant in Detroit. So we're having a ton of fun going out of the cardiology world into the real prevention world. Crazy stuff.
And how long has that restaurant been open?
Future of medicine.
Yeah, we're going to open, we're having a one-year anniversary December 1. So we're going to be in that 10% of restaurants that make it a year, and we plan to be here 30 years from now, too, when grandchildren are the sexiest vegans.
Well, people need this information all over the country, but I imagine Detroit is in especially needing this information. There's a lot of depressed areas in Detroit, and when people don't have access to healthy food, they tend to choose what they can get, and it's not usually what's good for them.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, surprisingly, just to give Detroit its rebirth a little plug, it, in the last 6 months, made a list of the top 10 vegan cities in the United States, and somehow made a list of the top 10 vegan cities in the world, which is deserving because we're part of that, created a restaurant, Green Space Cafe, that is the leading light in the city in that regard. But and we have the largest, oldest farmers market in America. So there is improvements going on. But sure, is the average child in the inner city having easy access to fresh produce? Not as much as anybody would like to see. School meals, hospital meals, vending machines, you know, it's not ideal.
Now, Victoria, you've been training a lot of soldiers to go out there and train people to make more people plant-based friendly. So we need to thank you for that and the Main Street Vegan Academy. Are you with us?
I am. I'm listening.
Good.
I'm taking all your compliments.
Okay, here I'm throwing them at you. Virtual hugs, virtual love. tell me about some of the people that you've touched and trained, not just with your books, but with the one-on-one training.
Well, the Academy is amazing. When Main Street Vegan came out, a lot of things started popping. The Main Street Vegan podcast came out of that, and this idea for an Academy to train coaches, and we did it the first time, and everybody loved it, and then I thought, well, will anybody come the second time? And we actually got some help for the next 5 classes from the American Vegan Society, and by then, the Academy was up and running on its own, and people knew about it. So 4 times a year, people come from all over the world. We've had graduates from Australia, South Africa, my favorite, Saudi Arabia, an 18-year-old NYU student who wants to go back and start PETA Saudi. And my husband, who's actually lived in that part of the world, said, isn't she afraid for her life? And I spoke with her mother, and the mom said, you know, I think as long as she kind of says, you know, tones it down for the one holiday when, you know, they're supposed to eat meat, I think we'll be all right. And so what happens here is that they get this complete immersion in every aspect of the vegan lifestyle, health, nutrition, fashion, environment, animal rights, and then they learn how to communicate all of this and then how to make it a business. And what's interesting is, as much as we love our nonprofits and we love supporting all the animal sanctuaries and these groups that are putting the undercover footage out and all these great things, so much is happening in the vegan world, in the world of business. Whether it's food or restaurants, one of our graduates has Riverdale Cheese, sweet little vegan cheese and gourmet shop in Brooklyn. Another one of our graduates is starting a yogurt company, Bright Life Foods. We've got an ice cream company in Toronto, Pleasantville Creamery. It's just amazing how entrepreneurial we tend to be as a group.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like an exponential thing because the need is growing and people who want to have a business see that there's a market, because it wasn't that way 10 or 20 years ago. there were lots of ideas. People wanted to start businesses, but they didn't know how they would grow. Unfortunately, now they're enhancing each other.
Yeah, and now people want the products, and so all we need are clever people to come up with interesting ones.
Yeah, that's all we need. Okay, back to you, Dr. Khan. What are some of the things that the people you've coached and the people you've treated, the biggest challenges they have to switching to plants?
Probably the cooking skills, the kitchen skills. I mean, they're interested, they want to do it, but, you know, what's step one? And, you know, Victoria probably has her approach. Honestly, I bring them to my restaurant. That's a nice approach in the last 12 months. Usually I see somebody at 2 o'clock and I see them eating a giant lentil burger, kale salad, wrap or something, you know, at 6 p.m. But what I've actually relied a lot, of course, always on 21-day kickstart that Neil Barnard has, and I love Rip Esselstyn's 28-day program, and I've taught at his immersion in Cleveland. It's wonderful. I heard your intro. Wonderful and well-attended immersion. These are all great things, but I've been using some of these online national food delivery companies, 22 Days Nutrition, Forks Over Knives, Plant Pure Nation, Bistro, and the rest, because for people that can do that, they can get that first week done. They can eat good food. They don't have to stress out while they're reading through the books and finding some easy recipes and going through Victoria's books and picking out ones. You know, I already eat that. This looks pretty simple. I can just substitute, you know, applesauce and flax for the eggs or whatever it is. And I just found that to make life easier. Their eyes bright up when they realize they're not trapped with nothing in the refrigerator.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that people can actually learn while they're transitioning with these deliveries what food is out there that they can actually eat and how tasty it is.
Right. And it's, you know, it's more expensive than beans and rice, but it's a lot less than going to a premier restaurant around the country for sure. So it can work out quite well for a family.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so you don't have a tour schedule or anything lined up yet? Or will there be one where people can find the Sexy Vegans Over 50?
Well, I'm suggesting, Victoria, you know, I think it's an international title. So, Victoria, how about Bali? I haven't been.
Fiji. I mean, I still would like to go to Israel and take the show on the road over there, because they've got more vegan stuff going on than probably anywhere. And we also hear that Germany and Italy are just going crazy. Yeah. And I've already written to the good people at VegFest UK to see how they would feel about having a couple of sexy vegans next fall, just before we turn the title over to somebody else. So
I'm
we will be out on the road. I mean, we've both got websites, and I'm sure we'll have all of our speaking engagements up there.
Okay,
you know,
sounds
good. The growth of veganism in Israel in the last 10 years is largely due to a Detroit man, Gary Yourofsky, and his animal rights activism that fits in so well with, you know, PETA's stance, and he's at my restaurant all the time. So let's make that happen, because, yeah, the restaurant growth there, places I ate at 2 years ago, they were general restaurants, are now 100% vegan restaurants throughout Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Really amazing.
I would love to get there again. I went vegan in 1988, and I was in Israel when it happened, and I was planning on it, but I thought I was spending 3 months there on business, and it seemed like an easy place to go vegan. There were plenty of vegan foods back in 1988, so, I mean, now it's probably just incredible. Well, Victoria Moran and Dr. Joel Khan, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and congratulations on being the PETA's 2016 Sexiest Vegans Over 50. You both deserve it.
And,
Thank you kindly.
You're welcome. And go forth and spread this important message. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was Victoria Moran and Joel Khan. And you can find Victoria at mainstreetvegan.net. And you can find Dr. Joel Khan at his website, Joel Khan, drjoelkhan.com. And I'm Karen Hartglass, and this has been It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and please send me an email at info@realmeals.org. In the meanwhile, have a delicious week.